gonna put a little timer on here. I don't tend to go over, but, you know, nobody wants that.
Yeah.
So, I got sober in Philadelphia in 2010, March the 19th. It took me 8 years to figure out the March the 19th was 2 days after St. Patrick's Day, which was my last drunk. I didn't go out drinking on St. Patrick's Day. I just went out drinking and discovered 8 years later it was St. Patrick's Day. That's how I drink. I've been thinking all day about this. I was talking to my buddy who's actually speaking out in Virginia Beach tonight, and we were talking about this earlier. I was like, you're going to do so much better a job. You're a real storyteller. I'm not a storyteller. I'm more of a facts kind of guy. My wife reminds me all the time, don't lecture everybody. So, she's right. I have a tendency to get on little, like, soapboxes and tell everybody what they should be doing or not be doing, and I'm not very good at telling my own experiences, right? Like, and that's really what we're here for, is to have an experience. So I'm an alcoholic. I got sober March 19th of 2010. Like I said, it was 2 days after my last drunk, because I spent all of the 18th still drunk from the night before. It's actually a great story. I'm going to tell you the whole story right now, because I had no intention of going out drinking that night. I had gone to some therapy with my at the time, my girlfriend, who I would later get married to and then get divorced from. And we were going to therapy, and I was meeting with a therapist on a regular basis a lot, because I didn't know what was wrong with me. Kind of like the book says, it talks about, we go to the therapist, we're like, if we could only be honest, we might be able to figure this whole thing out. And the therapist sort of sniffed it out. She's like, I don't know, maybe you should go to AA or Al-Anon. These people seem to know a lot about alcoholism and drinking, and maybe you should just go and see what they have to say about it, and maybe you can find something there. I just filed that away for later. Well, about a month and a half after she gave me those meeting directories, my uncle came into town, and we were planning to all go out for dinner, and my uncle was staying at the airport, which, if you've been to Philadelphia, it's like on the outskirts of town. I lived downtown in Philadelphia and worked downtown, and so we had to drive from work out to the airport and back into the city to have dinner. And at the time, I drove a manual transmission car, which my girlfriend couldn't drive, and my uncle, being like one of us, was already three sheets to the one we picked him up at the airport. So I was a designated driver, and I knew ahead of time that I was going to be a designated driver. That was my plan. I was going to prove the therapist wrong, right? We sat down at dinner, and my uncle ordered a double Johnny Walker on the rocks, and I thought, man, that sounds like a good idea. I'll have one of those too. And 8 of those later, in a blackout, I don't even remember drinking all of them, to be honest. I drove everybody home in that little manual transmission car. And my uncle called me the next day, you know, like he always does. He says, man, that was a great time, wasn't it? I said, I don't remember any of it. So it must have been great. And my girlfriend was in the shower crying, mortified that somehow we didn't all die driving home when I was in that state. And that was the first of many, what does the book call it? Pitiful and incomprehensible demoralizations.
Yeah.
I thought for sure she was going to leave. I found out later at an Al-Anon talk where I was asked to speak as the AA speaker, and she was asked to speak as the Al-Anon speaker, that she had tried to leave several times before that, right? She already knew there was a problem. I wasn't aware of it. Many of my friends knew it was a problem. So, you know, right away, it should have been obvious that I had no control over drinking when it came into Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'll come back around to this, because I'm going to kind of bounce around in my story. But I thought, maybe it was just that one time, right? Thankfully, I sat around in AA meetings long enough to hear enough stories and reflect on all of the times that I had, and all of the times were like that. They were completely and utterly out of control. And probably the main reason I stayed through 6 months of being dry and miserable and wanting to kill myself in sobriety before I did anything about being a sober member in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'll talk a little bit about that too, because I think that's an important point, like the difference between abstinence, putting down the drink, and getting sobriety, like, as described in the 10th step. And that was really important for me to have that experience. So I grew up in a sort of normal home, right? Like everybody comes up here, either home's broken, or home's crazy, or home's perfect, or the parents were wonderful. My parents weren't that bad. My dad was pretty drunk all the time. He was also blind, and he blamed the whole world for how bad his life had turned out because he was blind, and it was just bad luck. And if everybody understood how hard it was for a blind man to get along in the world, they'd help him out a little bit, and he would do great because he was super smart. And he would just drink and listen to sports on the radio every night and then pick a fight with my mom, and we'd start again the next day. And we had events like the telemarketer that called in the middle of dinner and he ripped the phone off the wall and he threw it in the street, or, you know, the Cub Scout that would knock on the door just before dinner to sell, you know, tickets or raffle tickets or whatever, right? And he'd throw them off the porch. Or the time the dog, he left the grill lid off the grill after he flipped the steaks over and then got mad at the dog for stealing the steaks and tried to beat the dog to death with a spatula. Thankfully he didn't, because he couldn't see that well. But, you know, like that was what my experience with alcoholism was. I was like, well, that's alcoholism. I don't want to be like that. I'm not going to be like that. I'm not going to be that guy. Determined not to be that guy, became that guy. And he was a really smart, good-hearted man when he was sober. He helped me a lot in school. He helped me a lot in coaching me in sports, like giving me direction, like really good, helpful things when he was sober. But when he wasn't sober, he was the worst person to live around, right? Him and my mom were always on the quits, right? And I was thinking about this today because I didn't really understand the value of how many times I had, you know, where are you going? Why are you leaving this time? Why are you coming back? Conversation time and time again. And how in my high school days, I really resented my dad because I became aware of the fact that when I was very small, he had one of those weekends where they got in a fight and left and had another kid. And he was paying that bill like all through my childhood, and I didn't know about this until I was a teenager. And it was one of my biggest resentments I had to deal with in Alcoholics Anonymous. My wife's looking at me strange because I never told her this story. So, but yeah, it was one of those like, and then when I got sober and I did an inventory and realized like, he did that, I didn't do that. Like I don't even have to be concerned with it. Right, it was one of those freeing moments that I realized that sometimes our parents and whatnot make mistakes, and we end up suffering the consequences of our resentments and fears because of the mistakes they made. It's not on me to carry that around, and I'm grateful for my first sponsor helping me figure all that out and being able to make amends to my dad, even though he was dead at that time. My dad died before I got sober. He died a year before I got sober. He had a pulmonary embolism one morning and kicked over. I was actually out of town. Okay, so it's kind of morbid, but it's really funny. I was out of town, Washington, D.C., working, because I was working in food service at the time. I was helping do an opening gala event at this big museum in D.C., and I worked in Philadelphia. We went down to D.C. to help out the D.C. people, and my dad was supposed to get up the next morning and go to school because he was going back to school to get his master's degree. He was supposed to drop off some paperwork. My mom had just flown out of town that morning before I came back from D.C. to go visit some family out in Washington State. And the next day after the D.C. thing, I get a phone call from my mom, and I'm kind of like out of it, going into work, not sure, like just going to do some cleanup stuff at the regular venue. And I'm like, my mom's just calling again. And so whatever. And just like, you know, I'll talk to her later, send it to voicemail number. And she called like three or four more times. And I'm like, okay, I got to answer this. Like, she's calling a bunch. There's something up. And I answer the phone and she says, I can't get a hold of your dad. And I'm like, what? Wasn't he going over to the school this morning to drop some paperwork off? Of course you can't get a hold of him. He doesn't have a cell phone. How are you going to get a hold of him? She goes, no, I called when I flew in last night. He didn't answer the phone. I called again this morning. He didn't answer the phone. Like, he should have answered the phone or called me back at some point. I haven't heard from him. I'm like, I don't know. Maybe the phone's not working or got knocked off. Again, he's blind. It gets off the little nudge. Phone gets off the receiver. Doesn't really pay attention to it. He gets a little bit drunk. Doesn't pay attention to it. Like, this is not a normal, not an abnormal thing in our house. So I'm like, okay, yeah, I guess I'll go check on him. So I go tell my boss. I'm like, we got this stuff going on here, but nothing pressing. I can come back later. I got to just go check on my dad. He's like, all right, that's fine. We can finish off the cleanup stuff here later. Drive out there. And you know that feeling you get sometimes when you're like going to do something and you're like, ah, it's no big deal. I'm sure it's fine. And then it starts to build in your stomach and you're like, maybe it's not fine. Maybe this is really bad. Right, exactly. So I'm driving out there and I'm driving a little faster and a little faster and a little faster. And it's only like a 25-minute drive. I'm not driving like cross country or anything. And I get there and I'm like, there's something wrong about this. And I go in and there he is, stiff as a board in his reclining chair. Looked like he coughed himself to death. And I knew right away. So I was in the middle of finishing my master's in forensic medicine. So I knew right away he was deceased. He'd been dead for many hours. But I had to go through the whole, get the coroner out there, and they got to check him out, and the EMS got to check him out, and finally get it all sorted out. And I was still drinking. So, like, what did I do after that? I went to a Ruby Tuesdays and started drinking, right? And that's how you fix that. It's miserable, it's terrible, I feel awful, I hate him for always being a mess, whatever, you know. Hate him for being blind, so I'm gonna go drink. That's what I did. And thank goodness for Alcoholics Anonymous, because 4 years after that, so I was 3 years sober, I happened to know one of the professors he was working under, because I had had classes with this professor, and it happened to be that this gentleman was involved in Civil War reenactment, and my dad's big thing was Civil War, as is evidenced by my first name, right? Okay, maybe that joke just doesn't work anymore. It's a little old. So we were able to put a memorial together at Gettysburg, which is a major battlefield that my dad was always very interested in the history of, and able to commemorate him and have a ceremony for my mom and make amends, you know. And that was like one of the more freeing moments of my sobriety, is like to just realize that he was just another guy doing the best he could, and he did good by me, and he taught me a lot of great life lessons, and I don't have to hate him for it. I'm just very grateful for the fact that you guys have given me that. Was really important because it was part of my amends to my mom, because my mom, when my dad died, we got rid of my dad as quickly as possible. My dad's brother and I managed to get him cremated as quickly as possible before my mom could come back from Washington State, right? Remember I just said she was out there? We managed to circle the wagons and take care of all the ceremony stuff and get rid of him before she got back, so she didn't get the opportunity to say goodbye to her husband. And I had to make amends for that. And that was also a very powerful moment. And so I'm telling you all these things because I'm not up here as a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous because I'm a great guy. I'm an alcoholic and I like to ruin people's lives, and I like to ruin people's lives as long as it makes me feel better about myself. And so until I could come to grips with that and make amends and clean up my life, I didn't get any better. Like, I came to Alcoholics Anonymous with this deep sense of purposelessness. I wanted to die every single day. I would go to work, I would cry at work, I would go home, I would get drunk, and I would hope that I wouldn't come to the next day. Right? Like I had this routine where I, in spite of the fact that I had a couch and a television in my little tiny apartment, along with a bed, like I had some furniture, I actually had one of those, you know, those really cool sports lawn chairs, the like canvas ones, you throw on your back and you carry everywhere you go. I had one of those set up in my living room right in front of the television, and I would come home and take the, I would stop, pick up a case of beer, set the beer in front of the refrigerator, empty all the bottles in the refrigerator, take all the cold ones out from the day before that I loaded up and put them in the box. I would set the box next to the chair. I would get out one of my books that I was supposed to be studying for school and turn on, like, I don't know, baseball, hockey, whatever sport was on that night, and proceed to drink the whole case of beer and try to read the book and then pass out at some time in the middle of the night, come to, go to the bathroom, and go collapse on the bed and then start all over again the next day. That was like the end of my drinking for like 2.5 years. And I somehow got through graduate school that way, somehow maintained something like a relationship with this girl that went on to marry me after I got sober. And I was just kind of a mess all the time. But drinking wasn't always like that. If drinking had started out that way, I don't think I would have made it that far, right? Drinking started out like fun weekend parties, right? I went, you know, sneak out, go to someone's house, get drunk, sneak back in the house, you know. Or better yet was the fact that my dad always had a liquor cabinet full of booze and he was blind. So he never knew how much was in the bottles. So stealing alcohol from, I didn't have to worry about, you know, like people come over here, I drink the clear one because you can add water to that and you can never tell that somebody drank out of it. I didn't have to worry about that. He had gin, he had bourbon, he had Canadian Club. I just drank it. He couldn't tell. My mom drank the Canadian Club sometimes and I would steal drinks out of her Coke when she wasn't looking. Especially when I was a young kid, because I started drinking when I was a little kid, right? Like my first drunk was a scotch and water that was left unattended at a Christmas party when I was 1.5 years old. I don't remember that, but that's how life was in my house. But my dad would be like, go get me a beer. Okay, you have beer, drink some of the beer, give him the beer. He didn't know. My mom would make a Canadian Club and Coke and set it on the coffee table and go to take care of something or go to check with something with my dad, and I would steal drinks out of it, right? Like 6, 7, 8, 9 years old. But I discovered drinking like I like to drink when I was 12, when we stole some peppermint schnapps out of my friend's mom's liquor cabinet. And I didn't know that peppermint schnapps taste like hot tamale candies. I didn't know what it was going to taste like at all. And I was just like, this is wonderful. And I have a horrible hangover and my friend's puking his guts up, but we drank that whole bottle playing video games on a Sunday morning, right? He's like crawling out of the bathroom and I'm just like laying in the room staring at the ceiling and I'm like, this is amazing. I can't wait to do this again, right? And so then I was too young to really take advantage of it after that. But I had, like I said, I had access all the time at my parents' house. And then when I got to be in like 15, 16, 16, 17, when some of the kids in my class could drive and that kind of thing, my parents didn't want us out drinking and driving. So they're like, just bring everybody over here. You guys can just party at our house and pass out on the floor. And my friends all thought my parents were great because of that. And I hated my parents because of that. Because I was like, how is it you're cooler than I am? Right? That didn't work for me. So I went through this whole like phase of trying not to be like my dad in high school, because we had been in and out of like fights over like him drinking, him not drinking. He stopped drinking a while in high school, like, because I kind of put him on that preference pledge, like, you need to stop drinking and help me get through high school. I'm going to this fancy prep school. I'm going to need help, like, blah, 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 blah. And he didn't drink for the 4 years that I was in high school, but he's the most miserable person I'd ever been around. And at that time, I didn't know what alcoholism was. And then I got into college, and he started drinking again, and I started drinking, and I started discovering college drinking's way easier. There's way less problems with it. And I would go to frat parties and grab a folding chair, and I'd pay the $7 for the cup, and I would grab a folding chair, and I'd plant the folding chair in front of the refrigerator or the keg or whatever they had as a source of alcohol, and I would sit there and hand out drinks and drink drinks. Like, you know how easy it is to get loaded on beers if you sit in front of the refrigerator and every person who comes by, you hand them a beer and you drink a beer for every beer you hand out? Like, I could drink 6 beers in an hour. Like, it was great. And I thought it was fantastic. I don't know. Like, some of my friends thought it was repulsive, but I had a good time. And then towards the end of college, my one friend who doesn't drink at all, we decided to celebrate him by going gambling, right? He doesn't drink, so we got to come up with something to celebrate that he's 21 now. And so we win some money in a casino in Atlantic City, and we find a bar restaurant where we can order some food. And me being me, I'm like, well, it's time to drink. They have drinks here. Let's drink. And my friends all are like, well, you know, I guess a beer won't hurt. We'll have a beer, blah, blah, blah. I'm like, I need a 12-ounce martini and some shots, and you all need shots. And needless to say, they were scooping me up off the floor and sending me to Atlantic City emergency room that night, where I came to in the hallway asking the nurse why I was all soaking wet. I was like, who poured water on me? She goes, honey, nobody poured water on you. You pissed all over yourself, right? And that was not the first or the last time I ever pissed all over myself. And I don't tell you that. Like, I remember when I was first sober, people were like, if you didn't piss on yourself, you're not a real alcoholic. I don't know. That's irrelevant. But I definitely did a lot of it. I also did a lot of puking in my own bed, right? Did a lot of just gross, disgusting things. And so my friend, so I'm telling you that this story about almost dying in Atlantic City for this point, because my friend at the time, he called me up like a week after, and we were very good friends. He went on to be the best man at my first wedding, and we're still good friends today, even though he lives in northern New Jersey, so it's kind of hard to stay in regular contact. But he calls me up, and Matt says to me, he goes, I need you to come over to my house. Now, at the time, he was staying at his parents' house in northern New Jersey, and I lived in South Philadelphia. So coming over to his house, him asking me to come over to his house was not like, come on down the street, let's talk. It was like, you need it, like, next Sunday, you're going to drive up here, and you're going to have brunch with my parents, and we're going to sit in my house, like, come to my house, right? And his parents were lovely. They always had me over. They were very kind. Even after I left the college where we were going to school together and we stayed friends. That's not related to alcoholism, so I'll leave that part out. That's not as exciting. I went to his house, and his parents made us breakfast, like a brunch, and we all sat and had chit-chat and caught up. His brother stopped by, who was a little older than him, and I knew his brother John, and we chatted for a little bit, and then kind of everybody dispersed, and he's like, come with me. So he takes me in his room, right? Like, okay, what's happening now, right? Like, I'm the furthest thing from what just happened in Atlantic City a little over a week and a half ago. Like, what's happening now? He sits me down on the bed, and he goes, we need to talk, right? And this is probably the first, maybe even the last time anybody ever tried to convince me that I had a problem. He's like, I don't, he's like, we went to school together. We took a lot of the same classes. I know in some of those classes we learned that what you're doing is not normal. There's something wrong with you. He's like, I don't know what to do for you. I don't even know how to help you, but I'm concerned about you. You need to seek some help. And I'm like, yeah, you're probably right. I'll look into that. Now this, mind you, was 5 years after I told, like, freshman year in college when I drank too much one night, and I told my roommate the next morning, like, hey, if you ever see me drinking because I'm feeling emotional, like I'm sad or whatever, angry or whatever it is, just don't let me drink that much, right? Like, some insight I had about it, I don't know. So that was me discovering that there was something abnormal about my drinking, but I didn't know what it was. And I didn't think that drinking was the problem yet. So, like I said, fast forward, I get drunk my last time and scare the hell out of everybody. And then I get sober. I come to Alcoholics Anonymous, like literally the 19th, I came to Alcoholics Anonymous after I went to the Al-Anon meeting to make sure it wasn't everybody else's drinking that was my problem. And when I discovered that nothing they had to say at the Al-Anon meeting made any sense to me, I was like, did you guys say there's an AA meeting downstairs tonight? They're like, yeah, it's right after this meeting. I'm like, oh good, I'm gonna go down there and find out what they have to say. And I belonged. I've heard a lot of things in Alcoholics Anonymous. I immediately belonged. I heard your stories and I was crying and I was like, this is where I belong. I know I belong here. I don't want to belong here. That was really my protest. I don't want to belong here. I don't want to be an alcoholic who can't drink. I want to be the special exception. And I was talking to a guy today who that was exactly the conversation we had. He's like, if I get treatment for this other thing and that gets better, then I'll be good. I'm like, except are you didn't you just tell me you're an alcoholic? If you're alcoholic, I am an alcoholic. You're going to have to treat both. And hopefully he does. Because like I've watched, like I shared with him, I sponsored a guy in Florida some years ago. Let's see, that was 2017. And he was in the Army, like just gotten out of the Army. PTSD, had all these other problems. Felt like he needed it. Like he started getting sober. He started doing his fifth step. Started like getting this thing right. And he decided he needed to do this other mental health stuff that he had going on. He would take care of that. And he disappeared for like 4 months when he went away to this other treatment, whatever that was. To this day, I don't even understand it. And he came back, and within a week of coming back, he got drunk. And then they found him in a hotel room with a pistol in his mouth. And that's not the first time I've encountered somebody in Alcoholics Anonymous who just decided they wanted to go some other direction, and then they're dead. You know, I said early sobriety, I was still questioning like whether or not I belonged here. I kind of crossed this threshold of like, okay, so I'm gonna try to remember this. I remember sitting at home this one afternoon, and I was reading As Bill Sees It, and there's a section in there that's like basically you have to come to the conclusion that you're not going to drink for the rest of your life, but one day at a time, right? And I had this aha moment, right, where I was like, no, I think I really am committed to not drinking ever again, so I'm willing to do whatever it takes to do that. But then I had that lurking notion, like, what if there's that one time, that wedding, that funeral, there's that one time that, but I'm really committed to this, right? And then I go into this meeting the next day, and I'm sitting next to this kid who I'd seen a couple times before, and he had maybe 30 days, and he looked bad. And I was like, are you okay? And he's like, oh, I don't know. I don't know if I'm going to make it. I'm like, what? Like, talk to me. And we'd try to talk to him, and then I tried to talk to him after the meeting. He didn't want to say much, and I was like, why don't you meet me tomorrow? We'll get some coffee, blah, blah, blah. I was like, I'll call you tonight, and we'll meet tomorrow. And I called him. He didn't answer. And I left a message of where we could meet. He didn't show up. And I found out 4 days later, he hung himself in his parents' basement that night, right? And that's heartbreaking. Watch so many people go that way, and somehow I'm not that guy. I didn't end up that guy, right? And I was, when I came in, my first year in Alcoholics Anonymous felt like every day was going to end that way. Like, I just don't know if I got it in me to make it another day. And I did. Like, for 6 months, I did it enjoying the company of coming to Alcoholics Anonymous, being here at these meetings, even at like 4 months, 5 months, and started to get a little bit testy. You know, the nice lady who had like 45 years would come up to me and be like, it's gonna be okay, you're a miracle. And I'm like, I'm gonna punch you in the face and set your car on fire. And she's like, oh, you're so serious, it's okay. Like, so stressed out. Like, I remember being asked to speak on step one, and I'm like, I don't know the first thing about step one or what you're talking about. Like, like that was me speaking on step one for 10 minutes straight, right? And all the old timers afterwards like, thanks, keep coming back. We're gonna tell you about step one. And I was like, I hate you guys. But then I got to a point that I, for the first time, I heard this man share probably the same exact thing I heard him share in a meeting 70 times before. But for the first time, I heard my story. I heard my pain, my sadness, my misery for the first time. And I went up to him. I was like, I don't know what you're doing or how you got there, but I would like to do that too. And he's like, great. Come see me next week at this time. We'll meet. And he shows up and he's got a big book. He's got a 12 and 12. He puts them in my hand. He's like, we're going to read these pages and we're going to do this and we're going to meet every week at this time. And we did it. And I didn't want to do it, but I kept doing it because somehow I knew that despite the fact that I came here certain that God was a myth, just a hoax, and certain that you guys were crazy and probably impossibly nuts, and I was probably better than you, I was going to do this because I decided that maybe if I did this, I wouldn't have to kill myself. And I just didn't quite have the guts yet to do something about that. Like, I wanted to die, but I didn't want to put a gun in my mouth. I didn't want to drive off a bridge. Thought about it a lot, but I just didn't want to do it. And little by slowly, I did the 12 steps with my sponsor, and I went to Arizona. I was interviewing for medical schools, and this was my second time at applying to medical schools because the first time I dropped the applications in the mail a week before they were due, thinking, you know, there's a revolving process. I was still drunk at that time. And my sponsor had told me, why don't you just turn them in early? You've already done them once. You have all the paperwork ready. Just change the dates. Like, do it again. I found out later that he was also a physician, and that's why he knew that that would work. Like, aha, he knows something I don't know, which is the story of my life. And as I was interviewing for medical schools, I went to this clubhouse in Arizona. And I was in this sort of weird place because I was writing inventory. And when I wrote inventory, it was mostly on days where I met my sponsor in a Dunkin' Donuts for an hour. So I just sat there and he drank coffee and I wrote inventory. And I was like, this is weird. I don't know about this, but it worked. So when I went to Arizona, I was in the middle of that process and I met this old timer. And the reason I met this old timer is during the meeting, he shared at 25 years sober, having stopped at a traffic light after a guy cut him off, and he pulled out his Colt 45 and he went up to the guy's side window and put the Colt 45 to the window and he said, you ever do that again and I'll end your life at 25 years sober. And I'm like, that's my kind of... I relate to that kind of anger. Like today when the auto dealership was trying to program the key for the car that I bought yesterday at the auto dealership, and they couldn't do it for 3 hours. And finally, I'm like, so what's happening? And they're like, well, when we put the key in, when you go to turn it on, the new key is supposed to make the lights come on like the old key does, but it's not working. I'm like, so what you're telling me is the key is not cut right. And they're like, yeah, that's what we're telling you. I'm like, okay. But I've learned through constant failure at this and fall into anger and resentment to like, okay, can we just do this another day, right? Because not 6 months ago, I was at another AutoZone and the AutoZone guy couldn't find the part that I ordered and I proceeded to lose every ounce of my sanity on this guy for 20 minutes. And he's like, you're gonna just have to leave now. And I had to go back. I call my sponsor about it. He's like, you're going to have to go make amends. I'm like, the auto part's not that important. He goes, but your spiritual condition is. You're going to have to go make amends. And I'm like, oh, good point. So I went and made amends, and the guy handed me the part. I wasn't expecting the part. I was just expecting the guy to nicely ask me to not come back to the shop again because I'm a maniac, because I acted like a total psycho like 2 weeks earlier. And he's like, oh, no, I forgot about that. But and by the way, when you were doing all that, whatever that was, I ordered you the part again. So here's the part you were looking for, right? Like, God, miracles, it's real, right? Like, I didn't believe it. I hated that people would say, you were all miracles. I'm like, you need to look that definition up in the dictionary because I think you're nuts and you don't know what you're talking about. I literally would share that in meetings. I don't know what you're talking about. And I also know why we're talking about God, because that's just make-believe, right? I believe it today. I have a God of my understanding today. I have a power greater than myself, and I absolutely need it. Otherwise, I completely lose my mind on people. And I'm very grateful because it allows me to have a family life today. It allows me to have a wonderful family life today. It allows me to have a wonderful connection with all you people. I'm going to segue real quick because I just want to thank all the members of my home group that came out tonight. Right? Like, I don't expect anybody to come hear me talk. If I get asked to talk, I know it's my service commitment. Like, it's my commitment to Alcoholics Anonymous. So if somebody comes out and supports me, I'm appreciative. Also, some members of my wife's home group came out to hear me talk tonight. So thank you for that as well. And my wife and I are absolutely blessed. Like, we met after our divorces, and we met over coffee to try and complain about our divorces. We fell in love. And we both spent the next several months telling our friends and our sponsors, like, this is impossible. We're not doing this. It's not God's will. And needless to say, it was God's will, I think. I definitely believe that today. Like, I've never been happier or luckier or more proud of the relationship that I have today with my wife. And it's not perfect. Like, we still have, like, difficulties with the kids and our exes and stress in our work lives. Like, we both have to work our program. And I'm grateful that we both get to work our program, because neither one has to manage the other one's program. We just, you know, we both call our sponsors. We show up in front of you people. We talk to alcoholics on a regular basis. We try to help others as much as possible. And because of that, we have a great life. And we have a great deal of love. And she told me not to cry. I'm going to cry. We have a great deal of love because I never knew any other person could care as much as she does for me. Probably one of my greatest character defects is that fear of not belonging, not connecting with other people. I never feel that way with her. I hope you get that too. I hope you find that too. And many other miracles that have happened to me. Like, my mother-in-law helps us all the time. Like, gives of herself way more than anybody really should. And I'm eternally grateful for it. And it's amazing. And unlike my own mom, who's really progressing with dementia, and we really just can't bring her in and take care of her. Like, it's kind of heartbreaking to not have that connection with my own mom, but I get to have that connection with my mother-in-law because she's here. And I have learned to capitalize on having good relationships with the people who are here. And our kids are amazing. They are. They're all different. They're all little different versions of us. And we're so lucky. Like, I can't even imagine having such a diverse and wonderful little family of kids. And I mean, I came into Alcoholics Anonymous convinced I wasn't ever going to have kids. Even when I got sober. Because I'm like, I'm too broken. Why would anybody let me have kids? And God saw fit for me to have kids and to have stepsons and hopefully be a good example in their lives. I never thought that was possible. And you guys gave that to me. All of it, they're gifts, they're blessings. And if there's nothing else that I can express, is like this deep sense of gratitude. I was writing a gratitude list this morning, and thinking about the fact that like I have abundance beyond any abundance I ever had before. Monetary, emotional, personal, relationships, like just so much. And this wonderful spiritual connection with God that allows me to be connected to all you and that be helpful to others. And when I think about that, I think about the fact that when I came in Alcoholics Anonymous, I was nothing short of trying to die. And I am not deserving of what you guys have here. When I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, that's how I felt. And you guys walked with me and showed me that I do deserve that. And we all deserve that. And we can all get there together. So if you're new, welcome. We would love to extend a hand of helpfulness. It is my great pleasure to be of help to other alcoholics in need. And if you're suffering, as I've done many times in Alcoholics Anonymous, drifted away and suffered in misery of alcoholism without a treatment, stay and reconnect. That's all I got. Thanks.
Thank you, Grant. And really, not being a Weisenheimer, but you are a miracle, and thank you for sharing your story. The greatest thing about Alcoholics Anonymous is walking into a room full of people who openly acknowledge how crazy they are and then laugh about it. Into Action is a home group. I apologize. I about skipped over. Our seven tradition states that we are fully self-supporting funds gathered at the meeting are given to the GSO and to pay rent and to accommodate the operation of the Into Action meeting. The rest is given to the Tidewater Intergroup, District 24, and the GSO. Announcements. Are there any AA-related announcements?